Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's program, sponsored by the University of San Francisco Center for the Pacific Rim, in co-sponsorship with the Commonwealth Club of California, the Fromm Institute, the Japan Society of Northern California, the Asia Society of Northern California. I'm Father Stephen Privet, President of the University of San Francisco and member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors. Tonight's program will feature distinguished scholar Dr. Chalmers Johnson in conversation with Dr. Patrick Lloyd Hatcher, Kuriyama Distinguished Visiting Professor at the Center for the Pacific Rim at USF. Before I turn the program over to Professor Hatcher, let me say a few words about Chalmers Johnson. Chalmers Johnson taught for 30 years from 1962 to 1992 at the Berkeley and San Diego campuses of the University of California and held endowed chairs in Asian politics at both universities. At Berkeley, he was chairman of the Center for Chinese Studies and of the Department of Political Science. His BA, MA, and PhD degrees in economics and political science are all from the University of California at Berkeley. From 1968 until 1972, he served as a consultant to the Office of National Estimates of the Central Intelligence Agency. In 1976, Chalmers Johnson was elected a Fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Chalmers Johnson has written some 16 books, including Blowback, The Costs and Consequences of American Empire, in which he linked the CIA's clandestine activities abroad to what he termed disaster at home. In his next book, The Sorrows of Empire, Militarism, Secrecy, and the End of the Republic, he explored the ways in which the growth of American militarism and the garrisoning of the planet have jeopardized this country's stability. Blowback won the 2001 American Book Award of the Before Columbus Foundation, and Sorrows of Empire won the 2005 Gold Medal for Nonfiction conferred by the Commonwealth Club of California. Professor Johnson's newest book is Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic, in which he contends that America's imperial overstretch is undermining the republic itself, both economically and politically. This will be the basis of this evening's discussion. And now, please welcome Chalmers Johnson in conversation with Patrick Hatcher.
Chalmers, I first met you in 1976 on the Berkeley campus. That was the 200th anniversary of the Republic that you say is now disappearing. I just finished reading your book. I was in New York. I watched 7 plays. Everyone died in every play. And for light reading, I had your book. I don't think I've ever been so depressed. Let me give the audience a little taste of it. In chapter 1, we're all on this big ship going down not the Mississippi River with Mark Twain. We're going down the Niagara River, and we're getting very close to a sound that we can hear, and a lot of haze in the air, and apparently it's Niagara Falls. And we, the people of the United States, are on this ship, and we're going to go over those falls unless something happens. Is this your image of America today?
Yes, it's one of them. There's quite a few images, but it is the main point I'm trying to make, however, in this vivid imagery, is that history tells us there's no more unstable political combination than that of the United States today, namely a domestic democracy and a foreign empire. You can be one or you can be the other. You can be democratic or you can be imperialistic. But you're going to lose it if you try to do both. That's what happened to the Roman Republic. It turned into a military dictatorship. It's important to us because the Roman Republic was an important source of precedence for our own constitution. I contend in the book that there is an alternative. I think we ought to be considering it more vigorously than we are, namely the British after World War II, not beautifully, not intelligently, and with a lot of mistakes, but nonetheless, they realized after the defeat of Nazism, the only way they could retain the crown jewel in their empire, India, was through administrative massacres, which they had used many times in the past, and that this would no longer be acceptable. The British, therefore, gave up their empire to keep their democracy. I think that's something we ought to be thinking very, very seriously about in this country right now.
Well, maybe Tony Blair will tell that to the White House the next time he visits.
He's an atavism, a throwback. sorry.
I wanted to ask you another question. There is a wonderful part of the book over a subject so tragic and sad it's hard to even talk about. It is a prison in Baghdad that was used by Saddam Hussein for decades and then used by the American military, initially as a holding area. Later, of course, we know that torture took place there. You say in the book that there is in the Pentagon, around the rings inside the Pentagon, the world's largest office building, a sign started to go up. There was a picture of six of these young people who took part in the torture, and underneath this was written, the six bums who lost the war for us.
The six morons.
Oh, I'm sorry. Six morons who lost the war for us. And then you say that you would like to withdraw that six and add seven, and they wouldn't be the ones at the bottom, but the ones at the top. And the ones at the top, I think the names are familiar. There was Rumsfeld and others in the top echelon.
George Bush, certainly.
So I've got that right so far, right?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, it's hard even to imagine the damage done to the United States by the condoning and ordering of torture, which we now know it was ordered. The commandant at Guantanamo had been sent to Abu Ghraib in order to do precisely that. It came from the very top, certainly including General Myers, who was then chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. He has a long record of speaking of bad apples in cases of this sort. General Myers has actually planted orchards of growing bad apples around the world. He used to be the commandant in Japan. But it certainly also included commandant in Iraq at the time. I go into some detail on this. One of the things that I try to use in the book, it's of course controversial, but many of you will be aware of Hannah Arendt's. She was one of my teachers. Arendt, in her report on the trial of Adolf Eichmann in Jerusalem, called Eichmann in Jerusalem, she concluded the book with a single odd line. She said, so is revealed the banality of evil. She never explained it. She has testified since that she wasn't even too sure what she meant by it, except for the fact that Eichmann was clearly not a particularly monstrous or evil man. In fact, one of the things that came out in the trial is that Judge Landau had asked him, he claimed to be well-educated, had asked him to please recite for her Kant's moral imperative. Arendt, who's a very considerable political philosopher, said, I never heard it better expressed, that clearly he understood it perfectly well. She finally concluded that what was wrong with Eichmann was that he'd forgotten how to think. He'd become a bureaucrat. He followed orders. He wasn't much concerned with what he was doing, except that it was of some... he was a functionary, and he had stopped thinking. I raise this because it strikes me, in the case of Abu Ghraib, the photographs that were revealed, there was a Sergeant Darby. He's been badly persecuted for it since then. It was Sergeant Darby who sent one of his discs to Army investigators with the pictures on them, And it struck my mind, Darby was a guy who hadn't yet stopped thinking. He realized that what was going on was morally repugnant. The damage to the United States is inestimable. And moreover, bear in mind that that was before the election of 2004, in which George Bush this time did genuinely win the election by 3.5 million ballots. His wars, his crimes became ours.
One of the things about the book, though, that struck me in that particular arena was that the judge at the Eichmann trial, Israel does not have capital punishment, but in this one particular case, they did apply it. Eichmann was executed. His ashes were spread across the Mediterranean or thrown into the Mediterranean. But the judge made clear that as you go further away from these types of crime, the authority and the responsibility for them go up to the top.
Right.
And it has not been the practice in the American system to see that rather clearly. I remember when I served in Vietnam that there was a young lieutenant by the name of Calley. He was held responsible with a few other soldiers for My Lai 3, where in fact a report by Lieutenant General Piers indicated that the captain, Mendoza, the battalion commander, and higher ups should also be responsible. So I take it that you believe that the higher ups in the American chain of command all the way to the top should be held responsible for Abu Ghraib.
Yes, absolutely. There's no doubt about command responsibility includes it. We executed General Yamashita for the crimes against Manila at the very end of World War II when he wasn't even in the Philippines, but he was the commandant, and it went to the Supreme Court, and it was affirmed that this is command responsibility, things that happen on your watch. But Arendt actually uses the phrase desk murderers, and it also came up in the trial that Judge Landau used it too, that indeed the more remote you are from the crime, the more serious your culpability than those that were actually in the cell blocks.
Okay, I'm going to ask you a question now, pretending you are sitting in a New York audience. There is a wonderful play on Broadway, The Vertical Hour. David Hare, a British playwright, wanted to pose the question of these wars recently, Afghanistan and Iraq. So he has a brilliant young woman, academic from America, come to Britain and face a British surgeon in this argument. And she presents a very telling argument, which is, regardless of all the mistakes that could have been made and would made and were made, etc., there is a moral responsibility for those who are strong and able to rid the world of those who are evil. And so therefore she testifies in this particular play that she did go to the White House and advise the president, then President Bush, to do the war in Iraq, if you wish. So you're left there with this equation. Hare has given this very strong argument to this particular character in the play that the United States, a strong and powerful actor on the stage, having made many, many mistakes, all of which were admitted, nevertheless had this moral responsibility to rid the world of Saddam Hussein. What do you say to David Hare?
It's nonsense. That is to say, there's nothing that gives the United States such exclusive powers, strength least of all. That's why I call my book Nemesis. You'll recall she was in Greek mythology the punisher of hubris, the punisher of arrogance, the corrector of people who violate the right order of things. I believe she's present in the country now watching. Almost certainly. But it is to say the things that we did were not simply the attempt to right wrongs and to do it in a collaborative manner with others. After all, we have our president walking around every day, now repeatedly, saying things that are as anti-constitutional as you can find. I am the decider. I am the decider. Like hell, you're the decider. In this country, it's done consensually. There are restraints on what you do. Now then, similarly, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, our country began to make a series of truly hubristic errors. We concluded we had won the Cold War. Both of us actually lost it. It's just they lost it first because they were always much poorer than we were. That we were the new the global superpower, the sole superpower, the new Rome, beyond good and evil, exercising full spectrum dominance, that we could dominate the world through the use of military power alone. Once you get into that, and you start then thinking of things like preventive war, that's what the Japanese did to us at Pearl Harbor in December 1941, and similar other things of that sort, then you're not talking about the attempt to correct wrongs or to invoke... a week after 9/11, the president said that we are going to go forth and rid the world of evildoers. Now, I'm not a theologian, but I hear the president of this university giggling. That is to say, it's hard to think of anything stupider. The belief that you might do it through military force. That is, that imperialism is a form of tyranny. It never seeks the consent of the governed. It is done through military force. The most common image Americans have, and certainly people on the receiving end, of Americans in Iraq is a healthy young man surrounded by other heavily armed men kicking in the door of a private house, rushing in, pointing an assault rifle at a cowering woman, and hollering democracy in a language she hasn't any idea of what he's talking about. Now, that's not, I think, that is, if Hare can't get away with that kind of argument, in my opinion.
Okay, let me try another one that comes from the hallowed halls of your and my university across the bay. There is a member of the Bolt faculty who has made a very strong argument that these are different times, that after 9/11, one no longer faced the Wehrmacht or the Soviet Red Army, that one faced this very nefarious group of people who moved among us in ways that we could not discover using the old means we had. And so, therefore, new means and new methods were required. I think this is all summed up in a famous memo that has to do with torture. Mm. Now, are these new and different times so new and so different that one has to write new rules and new ways of fighting?
Well, it's a good question, but I think that's not the case, and that, in fact, it was both an error and propaganda on our part after 9/11 to try and justify what we had decided to do regardless of what was done to us on 9/11. Instead, what we actually saw was an example. It's one of the few cases where I think Pentagon jargon is better than calling it terrorism. It was asymmetric warfare. A week after 9/11, Osama bin Laden published a document translated in every newspaper around the world in good Arabic, telling us with precision why we attacked. Three reasons. And they are not because we dislike your way of life, we dislike your lifestyle, we dislike your freedom, or any of the other why do they hate us nonsense that came from the White House. He presented three reasons for the attack. One, the U.S. placed troops in Saudi Arabia after the first Gulf War, allegedly to defend the House of Fahd. It was a bad way to do it if that was your intent, and that military power probably wouldn't do it anyway. But many young Saudis, including certainly Osama bin Laden, who was an ideal house guest at Kennebunkport, the child of a quite wealthy contractor, resented the use of infidels, Americans, in order to defend the two most sacred sites in Islam, Mecca and Medina. He secondly said, you Americans will never know peace so long as you support the Israeli side in seizing more land from the Palestinians. Finally, he said, we attacked because of 500 million Iraqi dead children as a result of the most severe sanctions ever imposed against any country. That was during the 1990s under the Clinton administration. Now, I'm not saying I agree with him, but these are casus belli. These are not abstract statements of principle or something of this sort. That these are reasons to go to war. Moreover, he'd been at it ever since we dumped them in Afghanistan. He represented the largest single clandestine operation we ever created, namely the recruiting, arming, sending into battle of the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s. Once the Soviet Union withdrew in 1989, we lost all known interest. The country descended into one of the worst civil wars in modern times. They all then ultimately cherished the Taliban for finally ending it for them. That's why I say that I think it's it's extreme for John Yeo at the Berkeley Law School to start claiming that signed treaties are now no longer relevant. We in the United States sponsored, endorsed, ratified the Geneva Conventions on the Treatment of Prisoners of War and Civilians in Wartime. Under the Constitution, a ratified treaty is the supreme law of the land. Neither the President, the Attorney General, the Secretary of Defense has any authority at all to tamper with them.
Okay. Before I launch into a question dealing with the Department of Defense, the audience doesn't know you anywhere near as I do. I'd like to point out that Professor Johnson once was a naval officer and served in the United States Navy, and the ship didn't sink. And so now that we have that clear, that you have served both DOD and advised later in your career as a person with specialties in the area of the Central Intelligence Agency, let me ask you about the Department of Defense. You, in your book, say that it is the victim of a kind of Keynesianism. Would you explain military Keynesianism to us in simple terms?
Right. Perhaps the most important warning ever given to us, other than George Washington's farewell address that is read at the opening of every new session of Congress, for good reason. But it is Eisenhower's farewell address, in which he invented the phrase military-industrial complex. He warned us about the unprecedented power of an arms industry, that we had a huge standing army. It was no longer, in any sense, a citizen army that was raised to defend the country. It had developed purposes of its own. The military-industrial complex is very clever. On a big project like a B-2 bomber, they can put a piece of that in every constituency in the country. If a member of man or woman, congresswoman, decides that we don't need a new weapon of mass destruction, they can be defeated at the next election by putting many of their constituents out of work. It works all the time. I mean, that is to say, it's perfectly logical for a Secretary of Defense to want to close redundant military bases, ones that are no longer of any value, sometimes as old as the Civil War. Well, every time you try it, every community in America surrounding that base, the preachers, the newspapers, everybody will rise up to high heaven, save our jobs, save our bases. That's military Keynesianism. The two mother hens of the Defense Facilities Subcommittee of the Senate Armed Services Committee are Kay Bailey Hutchinson of Texas and Dianne Feinstein of California. They're the states with the two largest number of military bases. Those two women would do anything in their power to keep the military bases open and working. I mean, I offer you a facetious example. The state of Washington has two lovely women senators, very liberal, very pleasant. Say the word Boeing to them, and before your very eyes, they will turn into bloodlusting fascist hyenas. That's military Keynesianism. That is to say, the use of the defense budget to provide jobs. And it's extremely insidious. We don't manufacture that much in this country anymore. By the way, military Keynesianism was not something that John Maynard Keynes invented. It was invented by a Polish economist during World War II to describe Adolf Hitler's first economic miracle, that is, the restoration of full employment before the wars ever began, through military spending. We spent over $5 trillion on nuclear weapons between the 1940s and the height of the stockpile in 1966. We never used one of them, fortunately, but it's about as good an example as Keynes's idea of putting money in disused mine shafts and then paying out-of-work people to go down and dig it up, why not just make weapons? Except that it leads to a vicious cycle. It leads to wars. It leads to the kind of problems we have today of a defense budget that is larger than all other defense budgets on Earth combined, and that's just the formal appropriation for the Department of Defense. There's nuclear weapons, which are in the Department of Energy. There's Veterans Affairs. There's several other very important sources of defense spending that aren't ever included in this. That's what we mean by military Keynesianism, is the militarism in this country is not just the Department of Defense or the professional military or things of this sort. It is, above all, increasingly a way of life to which the Americans have become addicted, and it would probably, in my opinion, be virtually impossible to stop it.
There is a theory at various universities about America and the genius of American politics because there is a pluralist model working out there. Don't laugh yet, Chalmers. Now, in this particular intriguing view, those who believe it would read in your book this very funny chapter where you say, well, let me tell you that in a baseball game, if the runner is coming into home and he's not going to make it and he reaches in his pocket and gives the umpire $100 and he makes it, we'd call that a bribe. And then you move on to the famous case where if there is a law case and the lawyer is losing it and he gives a judge $1,000 and he wins the case, that's a bribe. But if a senator is running for something and needs some money and someone gives him $10,000, that's a political contribution.
Right.
And so there's this sense that there is an imbalance because not all of us have $10,000 to give in these ways to various political campaigns. And you see this as a striking problem of the Republic or just something that can quickly be fixed?
Oh, there's no question that what has failed is the constitutional system. It's in shambles. If you believe the government in Washington, D.C., bears any resemblance whatsoever to the sketch of government outlined in the Constitution of 1787, the burden of proof is on you. It simply doesn't work that way any longer. I live in the 50th District of California. That's northern San Diego County. One of our most prominent citizens, Randy Duke Cunningham, is now spending 8.5 years in a federal prison for taking bribes from defense contractors, after spending a lot of time telling us about what a Vietnam War ace he was and things of this sort. Yes, the system is extremely badly broken. We have a good constitutional system for dealing with unsatisfactory political leaders and how to remove them in a peaceful and procedural way. It's called impeachment. The public last November elected the opposition party. The first statement Mrs. Pelosi had to say was, impeachment is off the table. If impeachment is off the table, then democracy is probably off the table.
Well, let me see. another suggestion that you have made in the book, and also have made recently in some of the interviews associated with the book, is that you would basically abolish the Central Intelligence Agency. Is this the case?
Yes. Let me try and explain it. The National Intelligence Act of 1947 establishes five functions for the Central Intelligence Agency. It was set up quite explicitly in order to prevent surprise attack and explicitly to prevent a recurrence of December 7th, 1941, that in order to collect intelligence open and through espionage and provide it to the president in a timely manner. Of these five functions, four are forms of intelligence collecting. The fifth is simply a catch-all. The CIA will perform what functions are given to it by the National Security Council, which is the president's arm for foreign affairs. It turns out that this is the only one that matters. The intelligence is not very good. As I wrote recently in an article, my wife used to ask me, why is this stuff so highly classified? Since you come home and say it reads like a lousy Foreign Affairs magazine article. My answer was, it's probably because it's the best we can do. It would be embarrassing to actually have it widely understood by that this is the best we could do. What's the other things that come along are clandestine activities, that is, overthrowing governments that we don't like, beginning with the Shah, Mohammad Mossadegh in Iran in 1953 for the sake of the British Petroleum Company. It's from that you can really get all the rest of it right down to Iraq today. Eisenhower was sold a bill of goods by the British. But such things as instructing Latin American military officers in state terrorism, assassinations, dirty tricks of one sort after another, so-called extraordinary renditions, that is, kidnapping people off the streets of Europe, flying them to, well, as the CIA likes to put it, if you want a good interrogation, you send them to Jordan. If you want them to just disappear, you send them to Egypt. And that's, most of them do just disappear. Most of them go to Egypt. These sorts of things turned out to be the root of social mobility in the CIA. This is where the money was. This is where it advanced rapidly. And most important of all, every president since Truman, once it was explained to him by the director of Central Intelligence on the day after he was inaugurated, he has this power. He has a private army at his disposal. There is no oversight of any sort on it. There wasn't any of any sort until the Church Committee in the late 1970s. Today we know, in light of Iran-Contra and everything else, the oversight is actually meaningless. When Charlie Wilson of the 2nd District of Texas became chairman of the House Oversight Committee, he sent a message to the CIA saying, the fox is now in the hen house. Do anything you want to, my friends. That was the quality of the oversight. No president, once he knew that he had this power, has ever failed to use it. That is, to sort of like the Signore di Notte in ancient or in medieval Venice. You can get rid of somebody if you want to, and it's very quickly, easily done. That's a cancer. It's gone too far. It's extremely dangerous. It leads to things like Guantanamo Bay. I believe there's probably no possible way of stopping it. Its budget is totally secret, always has been. No member of Congress can see what it's being spent on. It can be used in any number of nefarious ways, therefore, it seems to me, we're not now talking about reforms in the sense of Obama versus Hillary, we need some reforms like getting rid of this organization fairly fast before it does any more damage, cracking open the military-industrial complex, reducing the number of American military bases around the world from 737 to maybe 700. I'd be willing to get rid of them all, but there's still a lot of beautiful real estate out there that we own that the Pentagon probably wouldn't want to get rid of.
Okay, now let me see if I can get you into this little trap. The British gave up their empire, and the French gave up their empire, the two big empires from the European side given up at mid-20th century. They live in a democracy today. The British did not give up MI5 or MI6, and the French did not give up the Deuxième Bureau or Sécurité. So these two democracies that you actually give some good credit to in your book have held on to their version of an intelligence agency. So isn't there any possibility that the Americans might have to have something like that to collect some information?
Conceivably. I can think of it being done back in the State Department in a better manner. The CIA isn't that good at intelligence collecting, and particularly at espionage. We'd need to know a great deal more experience than this country actually has to ever bring it off. We go to war in Iraq with four people in the army speaking Arabic. Not exactly professional. When you consider the number of people during World War II that we trained in Japanese at Boulder and at the University of Michigan and places of that sort. Moreover, I really mean it when I say the British didn't do a particularly skillful job of it. They were reluctant. Lord knows Churchill was reluctant. There are huge atavisms now reveal the unbelievable war against the Kikuyu by the British in Kenya in the 1950s. The Anglo-French Israeli attack on Egypt in 1956. These were savage atavisms, throwbacks, And then we see it again today with Tony Blair. There's absolutely no reason on earth why the British should have joined us in Iraq, particularly given that they were largely responsible for creating this non-country of Iraq in the first place. And the chief result of their joining it was, I think, unfortunately, they will never again have, at least in my lifetime, well, no, better not say, I'm 75, so it's not much. They're not going to have any influence in Europe, and that's unfortunate. It's unfortunate for all of us. They could have been much more responsible about it than they actually were, instead of reenacting these ancient games of following the Americans. I want to resist the maybe, because indeed there would be plenty of people who would make the case that there are unusual things that do come up that require exchange of persons or things of this sort, and require a special kind of technique and knowledge that we have in the CIA, that the British have in MI6 and things of this sort. Generally speaking, their contributions to democracy, to security, to anything other than the comfort of the president are wildly overstated. Therefore, I'd be willing to give diplomacy a chance, as they say.
Okay, well, of course, for a long time, the State Department has had an office that does collect intelligence and still does. So,
and they're usually accurate.
Another little question for you. One of the things, I always look for these in your book so that I underline them, and I saw that, defense spending, which seemed to be such a threat in the book, declined in the Clinton years down to 2% of GNP. So it's possible that there is a way of controlling this large military expenditure in a state as rich and powerful as we are, cutting back to just basic essentials. Would you agree or think that Clinton was just an aberration?
Let me try not to be too snotty about this, but Rumsfeld just loves to tell us about the declining percentage of GDP spent on defense. Well, I guarantee you the DOD does everything. I mean, this is an art to study where the money goes, to study the Enron-style accounting that lies behind it. The Defense Appropriations Bill, which is today, once you add in also the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, is $750 billion. These don't begin to cover what we spend on defense. They are very carefully put together to make sure that they don't. We have an entirely separate budget called the Defense Facilities Appropriations Budget that covers all of our 700-plus bases around the world, as well as the others domestically. It has now become a national scandal, the degree to which we have underfunded the Veterans Administration's commitment to take care of people with wounds that will require care for the rest of their lives, and there's lots of them, and the evening news sells a lot of stuff telling us about the medical miracles that have kept these men alive from an IED under a Humvee in Anbar province. I just would want to say there's no greater source of... it's charlatans who hide behind percentage of GDP because the numbers themselves are so flexible, so misused, and there is such a huge vested interest in trying to understate the costs of the defense budget. And it goes on all the time. We have some great authorities on this subject. Many of them actually happen to be Republicans in the Republican side of the budget and policy committees in the Senate. They're old-fashioned Republicans, but they've worked on them for 30 years, and they're simply geniuses at the stuff. They've written good books. Congressmen could read them if they wanted to. The whole world of add-ons and earmarks and things of this sort that go into it. Then if you're on one of the secret committees, the Intelligence Committee, or the... remember, 40% of the defense budget is black. Nobody gets to see it. It's been that way since the Manhattan Project of World War II, despite Article 1 of the Constitution that says you will be given an accurate accounting of how your tax dollars were spent. That's not been true in this country for well over half a century, and the Supreme Court has always waltzed around it, said it's okay, they don't need to know. I just don't, I mean, there's no question that the budget was reduced to what might be called normal Cold War expenditures under Bill Clinton after the extraordinary expenditures of the Reagan first Bush years. Those were the extremely high armaments expenditures. Today, they're again off the chart on things that have nothing to do with national defense. They have to do with the weaponization of space. It is well known to all of them. Every single one of them knows. There's a library of reports on how they don't work. The answer is they're not intended to work. They're intended to make jobs. The important thing about them is they're expensive, not that they work. These interceptors that we put in the ground at Fort Greely, Alaska, and a couple of them at Vandenberg Air Force Base here in California, they've never once hit anything in a test that we've used. The leading Pentagon examiner calls them scarecrows. They might scare a North Korean missile flying over, and maybe he would go away as a result of being told they were in the ground. So that I don't buy it. I think that instead what we have is a record of extraordinary and growing dependence on the military-industrial complex, just as I say, the great presidential warnings we've had go back to George Washington, his really immortal lines, the great enemy of liberty is standing armies, and it's the particular enemy of Republican liberties. By standing, he was not opposed to war or anything else. By standing armies, he meant this will create that big building on the south bank of the Potomac. This will create a defense establishment. It will create the military-industrial complex. It will draw wealth to Washington. It will begin to cut into federalism, and it will ultimately, as he said, destroy the main bulwark against tyranny and dictatorship in this country, the separation of powers into the executive, judicial, and legislative branches. We have had, in Arthur Schlesinger's famous phrase, we have had an imperial presidency carried to extremes in recent times.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California's radio program with author and noted scholar Chalmers Johnson, who is discussing Americans' foreign policy and what he terms its imperial overstretch. Chalmers, one way to give up all these mini bases, these military bases that became like a mania for us to collect in Kyrgyzstan.
You've written on this,
haven't you? Yes, I've written on it. Kyrgyzstan, or all these other stands stretched across the former Soviet Union, has been argued in the Pentagon by people up to and including Rumsfeld as to, well, let's go into space. From space with high technology, with the California system that has been able to put certain kinds of weapons in smaller and smaller packages for surveillance purposes, with aircraft now that can fly from North Dakota all the way to Afghanistan and back with refueling and can't be seen on normal radar of the stealth, we could, in fact, give up much of this baggage from the Cold War and still protect ourselves and our allies from space. What do you say?
Well, I don't think it's protecting ourselves from anything. I think it's dominating the globe from full-spectrum dominance, as the Air Force likes to put it. The Air Force is extremely enthusiastic about these things. We have had repeated calls from other countries interested in the peaceful uses of space for a new regime, a new treaty, a new way to control weaponization of space. I believe we've been absolutely crazy to not do it because we, more than any other country, are dependent on both low Earth and high Earth orbits for communication satellites, for the space shuttle, for one thing after another, for every time you check out at the supermarket, your bill is going up to the satellite and coming back, you know, deducted from your bank account. The Chinese have gotten so tired of it that the other day they fired off one of their missiles to destroy an old in-orbit shot Chinese satellite. Well, of course, you may not know it, at Johnson Space Center, the Air Force keeps a wonderful account of the stuff buzzing around in the Earth low Earth orbit is 17,500 miles an hour. That's the speed at which the shuttle flies. That's a very delicate territory. It's filling up with junk already. The blown up Chinese satellites put a great deal more into it. Many of you will remember Sally Ride, who was the commandant of one of the Challenger missions and then became a professor down at Stanford. On her mission, a piece of paint whizzing around the globe at 17,000 miles an hour hit the windshield. And she said, I panicked. I wondered if any of us were going to go home. I could see the gouge out of the plastic. And she said, if a piece of plastic can do that, I hate to tell you what a lens cap, a wrench, a piece of junk in fact, it's already, there are some real rogue states that have crossed their minds, we can blind the United States tomorrow by simply firing a couple loads of gravel into low Earth orbit and let them buzz around and knock out all of those American satellites. Their computers will come to an end right then and there. And moreover, the Europeans are actually building a better global positioning system, Galileo, than the one that that we use. So that I find this talk about how we're going to defend ourselves by being able to, the cliches are endless. Wolfowitz used to love to say, it's the genuinely high ground. Well, yeah, it's awfully high. As if here we are, we've got the Indians down below us, and it gives us great advantages. It doesn't give us great advantages. And in fact, it probably gives advantages to the technologically poorly developed, like, say, North Korea, in order to defeat our remarkable dependency on some of the technologies that we use in space simply routinely. And there are, remember, a great many more peaceful satellites in space today than there are military ones, and there are more going all the time. It may be that within your lifetime, space exploration will simply no longer be possible. That is, the planet will be encased in whizzing debris, and nobody can get through it. If it's in high Earth orbit, it will never go away. It will be there forever. In low Earth orbit, it might very possibly, some of the stuff, descend into the atmosphere and burn up. But it's there's a outer space debris magazine. I can't remember the exact title of it now, that the Johnson Space Center publishes, but it is absolutely fascinating to read about an ancient Chinese weather satellite that was that had burned out. You can't repair them, remember. That was rear-ended by the final stage of an American rocket. And it broke into 25,000 more pieces for them to all record, give them numbers, train our satellites on them to keep an eye on them. It's really so pitiful to see the United States give up on cooperative ventures and listen to the kind of absolute nonsense one gets from the Air Force these days, chiefly because of the money involved. That is to say, these things are lunatically expensive, they don't work, and the testing has been a disaster. I mean, we fire them in Kodiak, Alaska, try to intercept them with a rocket from, needless to say, it would be called the Reagan Test Center in Kwajalein Island. Well, it's hard to believe. Lately, in our recent tests, the goddamn rockets didn't even take off. Now, we have a lot of experience in this country firing rockets, and we shouldn't anymore have to put up with things that just don't even go off. But they don't work.
I got the message.
We also have a huge space lobby. Don't kid yourself. Congress just loves it. Huntsville, Alabama lives off of it. That's where we brought...
Werner von Braun.
Yeah, I'm about to say SS Lieutenant Colonel Werner von Braun to build our first missiles for us. And there are numerous other communities. Boeing, Lockheed Martin's shares, very much dependent on it. So that it's, I think, what we need is a lot more skepticism, and we need a press that is a little bit more independent and performing the functions that Benjamin Franklin had in mind. He, you know, he didn't write Article 1 of the Constitution to protect People magazine. The alleged idea, he didn't care about their free speech. The purpose of the free press was to penetrate the secrecy of the bureaucracy and expose it to the public. If it doesn't do that, nobody needs a free press. It's not very free or very interesting anyway. So that all of these things come into play. Above all, what we don't have is an attentive, well-informed, and curious citizenry.
I got you. So I change the subject now. You know, Chalmers, when I visit you on a quarterly basis down in San Diego, I talk about films a lot. And I remember growing up, there was a wonderful film, and it was wonderful because Ava Gardner was in it, but also in it was Burt Lancaster, Kurt Douglas. It was called 7 Days in May, and it was an attempt to show you what might happen if there was a military coup in this country. Now, in your book, you point to a certain general who was in command in Iraq and who said publicly, if the United States were to suffer another strike, another terrorist strike, and then I can imagine a military takeover of the United States. Am I getting that paraphrase?
General Tommy Franks, commandant of the assault on Baghdad.
And do you think this was
quote
serious?
Unquote.
Yeah. You think it was serious?
Oh, I have no doubt it was serious. It's just, I think today, a Roman-like conclusion, that is, the coming to power of a representative of the armed forces, the creation of a life dictatorship, as in the case of the young Octavian becoming the god Augustus Caesar and ruling for life, and then followed by some of the most disreputable figures in history. I think this is unlikely in the United States for various reasons. One, the high command is so satisfied these days. They have they're well-paid, marvelous perks. The revolving door into industry is an extremely rich source of wealth for them. I think they have every reason to distrust whether the American public would accept as clearly an illegal order as you could give, namely to take over the government and install the military in some phrase that adds up to dictatorship. Moreover, I think they have reason to question whether the troops would obey their orders today. Within the armed forces, it is now very common among the ranks to understand that the torturers at Abu Ghraib or the killers of civilians in Iraq and others, enlisted men get prosecuted and go to prison. Officers go free. They are not persecuted. The result is that prosecuted, not persecuted, they're prosecuted. I saw a woman laughing and she reminded me that was the wrong word. The officers, I think, might very well, or put it this way, enlisted men in the armed forces today are getting to be, even though it is a professional army, has been since 1973, it's a career choice, it is not an obligation of citizenship. Nonetheless, it begins to have the smell of the old citizen armies, in that the troops are now much more suspicious of illegal orders and whether their officers know what they're doing and are doing it well. Therefore, I think that the officer corps probably would not attempt a thing like this. I don't really expect we could talk about whether or not you could imagine a grassroots movement in America to reconstitute constitutional government. My wife keeps saying to me, come up with something optimistic, would you? So I did. I said, I came up with bankruptcy. We would stagger along under a facade of constitutional government until, like, Germany in 1923, China in 1948, Argentina just 3-4 years ago, 2001-2, we would go bankrupt. It would not mean the literal end of the United States. It would mean the loss of virtual all influence in the world. It would mean a catastrophic recession. It might well lead to very considerable domestic unrest in this country as people were wiped out. We certainly have that. That is what happened in the richest country in Latin America, in Argentina, when it went bankrupt. But I think that I'm not Cassandra, though. I don't know how it's going to come out. It could be that Tommy Franks or other crazies might imagine that the only source of power, influence, and trust in its abilities in America today was the high command of the armed forces, and feel that it was their duty to intervene. That's what happened in Rome after the assassination of Julius Caesar had just been elected consul for life.
All right, the clock is running. I've been taking some of the questions from these that have been coming up from the audience. Here's another one. You worked for the CIA. What turned you around?
That's always a good question. I'm accused of being inconsistent. There's no question that I was a cold warrior. I regarded the Soviet Union as a menace. I still do. That is the old Soviet Union. John Maynard Keynes, the great English economist, when once accused of being inconsistent, replied to his interlocutor, when I get new information, I change my position. What, sir, do you do with new information? The new information was the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, particularly that bit of new information. It was the raison d'etre of our entire apparatus around the world, the whole world of the CIA and of the Department of Defense simply had disappeared. What shocked me more than anything else about it was how fast our country set out to find a replacement enemy. It happened overnight. It was going to be China. It was going to be drug lords. It was going to be terrorism, even instability. I mean, we need the military-industrial complex could not be threatened. Then there was one other thing that turned me around. I'm primarily a specialist in East Asian politics, China, Japan, the two Koreas. And I've devoted my life to the study of Japan, but I have never had been to Okinawa. Okinawa was, of course, the scene of the Battle of Okinawa of 1945. It's the southernmost island in the Japanese chain. It is a Japanese Puerto Rico. It is an island that has always been discriminated against. It was annexed to the Japanese Empire late in the 19th century, and it's a dumping ground for American forces. The Japanese like the Japanese-American Security Treaty, but they do not want for a day American troops located anywhere near them. Therefore, they are not on the main islands of Japan. They're dumped down into Okinawa, 37 American military bases, 17,000 Marines of the 3rd Marine Division, the largest military base we have in East Asia, Kadena Air Force Base. Revolt against them has been endemic for now 60 years. The rate of sexually violent crimes committed by American troops against Okinawan women leading to court-martial, which means, unusually in Japanese culture, she came forward and brought a case. The rate is 2 per month and has been now for 60 years. In 1995, there's a very serious incident in Okinawa. Two Marines and a sailor abducted, beat, and raped a 12-year-old girl. It set off the biggest demonstrations against the United States since the security treaty had been signed. Again, I had, like most Japan specialists, Okinawa, it was off the beaten track. I've only been in Puerto Rico once in my life, and I thought, if the revolution breaks out here, I'm going to walk to the wall, put my hands up against it, and say, shoot me quickly. There's no possible excuse you can offer for the way Puerto Rico looks like a mafia hangout. But in 1996, the governor of Okinawa invited me to come and talk with his staff about what had happened the year before and the demonstrations and things of that sort. And I have to admit, I was shocked. 37 American military bases on an island smaller than Kauai in the Hawaiian Islands, all the signs of the Raj everywhere, a lovely little sign at Yase Golf Course that indigenous personnel, that's Pentagon speak, indigenous personnel may play this course if accompanied by a freedom fighter. It's a little bit like the old, no dogs are Chinese allowed in this British park in Shanghai in the 1930s. But again, I thought Okinawa was exceptional. It was off the beaten track. We never got down there. The Marines were there like the Soviet forces in East Germany. They were living a lot better in Okinawa than they were in a crummy stateside place like Oceanside, California, next door to Camp Pendleton. So that it was, I thought, an aberration. That led to my second book, the one called The Sorrows of Empire, which I began to study the German bases, the Italian bases, the bases in England, the bases in Greece. There's probably no more anti-American democracy on earth than Greece. They will never forgive us for the Greek colonels, 1967 to 73, and they shouldn't. On September 11th, 2001, I was chatting with my publisher about, we didn't yet know who the terrorists were, and we were asking ourselves about it. Our first conclusion was, of course, they're probably Chileans. The date, September 11th, 1973, the date the CIA overthrew the elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile and installed probably the most odious dictator on either side in the Cold War, Augusto Pinochet. It turns out they happen to be Saudi Arabians, and for reasons I got the idea. Enough said on that subject.
Well, I'm taken aback, but I want to say that we're coming to that point in the evening where we have to close, and so I wanted to thank Chalmers Johnson, our noted scholar and author of Nemesis, The Last Days of the American Republic. We also, if this program has been, we want you to know the program is presented by the University of San Francisco's Center for the Pacific Rim and co-sponsored by the Commonwealth Club, the Fromm Institute, and the Asia Society of Northern California. So would you please join me in thanking Professor Johnson.